generation. God gives strength in loving arms, scatters the proud of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
Man is the most insane species. He worships an invisible God and destroys a visible nature, unaware that this nature he's destroying is this God he's worshiping. Herbert Reeves, who was born on July 13, 1932, a French Canadian astrophysicist who is now 87 years old. As of today, April 24th, 2020, the United States has over 891,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and nearly 51,000 Americans have died. Worldwide, the number of confirmed COVID cases has reached a staggering 2,763,080, and almost 200,000 people have died. I'm Debbie Dykes.
I'm David Dykes.
And welcome to part two of our second episode of COVID-19 and God with our special guest, Dr. Jörg Rieger. I'd like to remind our listeners, Dr. Rieger is the Distinguished Professor of Theology and the Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies at Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Rieger is also the founding director of the Wendlin Cook Program in Religion and Justice at Vanderbilt Divinity School, and this program is the first of its kind in that the program examines economic and ecological justice through the lens of theological and religious reflection. Welcome back, Jörg.
Thanks so much for having me, David and Debo. I really appreciate being on your podcast.
Well, we thoroughly enjoyed part one and are really looking forward to continuing with part two. Today, I think we're going to focus more on Jesus as a grassroots organizer. So, in your recent article that was posted on the Wendlin Cook blog site, you mentioned that because of the COVID-19 pandemic, people who depend on their investments for making ends meet or as nest eggs for retirement will find it more difficult to continue with business as usual. They will have to keep working long past their retirement age. And my question is, as people are awakened to a post-pandemic life, is there a greater chance that things will not return to normal?
Thanks for that question, Debo. I think there is a chance. That's what we're hoping for, that people who are waking up to what's happening are ultimately able and also maybe not just able but also willing to change things from the way they are. But what we also know is that these things usually don't happen by default. So even when people start realizing things, even when they start wanting something else, we still need to organize this. This is something that has to be brought together. You know, these insights have to be inspired, have to be connected to other people who have similar insights. And not just in a local place, but really sort of more broadly in communities, and also globally, internationally. That's what we're hoping for. And as a theologian, my hope is always that this is where faith can help us. Religion can actually do some good in addition to a lot of the problems that it has created.
Jorg, I want to just go back to something that was even covered in the last podcast, and that is I have a distinct memory of watching the news in 2009 and seeing the demonstrations on of the Occupy movement, and I had such hope. You know, I thought, wow, this thing could really grow, and in some ways, in all fairness, it has. I mean, it continued in the theme of Black Lives Matter and other things. But in many ways, in terms of the economy, it just kind of sank back into the sand. You know, it didn't. And so my interest is in hearing you talk about what could we do differently this time, and how can we shape a response that will continue?
Yes, thank you. If you take it back to the Occupy Wall Street movement, part of what's now forgotten oftentimes is that this movement didn't just fizzle out. It was actually physically destroyed. Mm-hmm. Remember the encampments that mm-hmm. we had, yes. You know, in the cities, mm-hmm. All around the country. And that year, that was back, when was it now? 2011, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was on sabbatical leave that fall, so I was able to actually visit a lot of the encampments. You know, we should not forget that each and every one of these encampments was actually physically destroyed by, you know, government forces moving in, oftentimes under the cover of night, heavily armed, basically taking out and ending the Occupy movement. Now, you might wonder why that would have been the case and why that would have been necessary. I think people were getting worried. There was a concern that this organizing was happening and that people were not just waking up to the problems, but they were actually beginning to do something about it, and that had to be ended. And unfortunately, it was ended, some of it very effectively. But as you're also saying, David, none of this ever disappeared completely. And so we have to not only recover and restart things that we did 10 years ago or 9, but it's a matter of seeing how they have continued. And that's, to me, the encouraging thing. There are various movements and groups around the country and also religious movements that have continued to work on these insights. One example, I think, is a religion and labor coalition that's not very well known in the public oftentimes, but that has been working all these years, and I've been part of that. And our new program, this Wendland Cook Program in Religion and Justice, is part of that as well. Yes. For your listeners that would like to look that up, our website is religionandjustice.org. That's one word, religionandjustice.org. And part of what makes our program unique, as you said in the beginning, is we're putting together ecology, economics, and religion. But we're doing that also with a view of workable labor is part of the conversation. And that's what makes it unique, you know, having all these things together and not forgetting not only what happened in the past, but what is still happening in the present. And that's where I find my hope.
Well, okay. Along that same line, how do we articulate a voice of radical solidarity in such a way that the executive class never forgets what this pushback is? I mean, is that a valuable concern?
It is a great concern, and solidarity, I think, is much needed. But it's not easy. We've seen this over the years. There are different concerns. They're sort of different, even in the movements themselves, there are different emphases. And then from the top, there's always divide and conquer. So it's not like, you know, you can easily just bring people together, because there's always this effort to keep people apart from each other. Go back to the beginning, to that quote that Debo read as an introduction, talking about this insanity of man that worships this invisible God. If a feminists were reading that, I think a feminist might say, you know, this is really a problem of men, maybe more so than women. And that
actually,
has to
I thought about yes. that. I almost thought about changing a little bit the language, but then I thought, nah, this is actually a quote, so I better not go in and make it all gender inclusive.
And we don't want to romanticize women necessarily, but what I think this quote says is men, and this, you know, in a patriarchal society, men are the people in power. They're the one who create a lot of these systems, or who are part and benefiting from a lot of these systems that we talked about last time in which we live. And then, of course, it's not just all men, but it is precisely men with power and wealth, the executive class that David just mentioned, and add to that race also, right? We might, especially in the United States and in Europe, have to say, you know, this is white men in power who have created a lot of this. And that invisible God that then is referenced in that quote very oftentimes takes the image of a white man, maybe even sort of European type, or maybe American type, right? And this is part of the problems that we're wrestling with. So in order to achieve that solidarity, back to the question that David just raised, in order to achieve the solidarity, we need to take a closer look at what is it that prevents us from achieving closer, better relationships and a more, you know, based on the ground way of life.
Well, you mentioned a little bit earlier a little bit about religion and economics and the church and church economics. So it seems like we can't really separate them, even though we are supposed to be separated, church and state. But so if they can't be separated, then why are we always told that church and economics represent two different worlds?
I wonder about that, Debo. If we're really told that, I mean, we're clearly told that church and politics, church and state, represent two different worlds, and there's some wisdom here in not mingling those completely or confusing those. That's historical wisdom that the founding fathers had, and they learned that from, you know, old battles where religion and state were just one thing and confused. But I'm worried that this is not the case when it comes to the economy. In some ways, while we have a separation of religion and state, we do not have a separation of religion and the economy. And what that means is that in many ways, in this current situation, the economy shapes a lot of our religious beliefs. You know, power and wealth have a lot to do with not just, you know, everyday business, but the way people think, what people believe, you know, their inner emotional contents and all of that. And so there's a danger that I see right now that this dominant economic system in which we live, and that's really unable to help us much in this COVID crisis, as we've seen, you know, this part of the crisis is not just the virus, is that the system is failing us to deal with the virus. And so if there is not a clear understanding that this particular system is different, perhaps, from our faith in God and the sort of things that Jesus taught us, then I think we're getting in trouble. And let me add one more thing there. There's an interesting book I want to mention also. Its title is One Nation Under God, and the author is, I believe, Kevin Cruz. And this is about how corporate America funded and in some ways even invented conservative Christianity starting in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So there's a history of, you know, what we're now seeing in terms of a religion that seems to be completely in bed with the dominant system. That wasn't always the case. This is not the way it was, you know, 100 years ago necessarily, but this is something that money and big money built. And so what we're seeing now is the results of big money, wealth, privilege, the executive class, creating its own religious paradise. This is the insanity of man, not religion in general, but it's a particular kind of religion that we have to be worried about.
That's right. You say in Jesus and Caesar.
Jesus versus Caesar.
Versus Caesar.
Yeah, I believe this book is published by Abington Press. Jesus versus Caesar. I don't remember the year you published this. It's your newest book, I believe.
This is the newest one. Yeah, I'm working on another one right now, but this one was published in 2018. So the title, as you said, is Jesus versus Caesar, and the subtitle, I did a little tongue-in-cheek subtitle there, says For people tired of serving the wrong God.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
because the basic argument is they're images of God that are really images of Caesar, the Roman emperor, images of power and wealth that are not images of Jesus, that are not images of the Christian God or the Jewish God, but they have been hijacked. And so a lot of people haven't realized that as yet. What would happen if we noticed this? What would be the alternatives?
Well, yes. that would require a lot of change, because not only what you said, but in terms of imagery, the Anglican tradition, the Roman Catholic tradition, they even dress like the clergy dress like Caesar.
Well, they dress like Roman wealth.
Yes,
people of wealth going to a party.
Certainly not like Jesus.
Yeah, they're wearing their finest clothes.
Yeah,
and let's skip a little bit forward. In the book, you describe Jesus building a different kind of power than the one that was used by the Roman Empire. Could you expand on that a little bit?
I think that is the big question here. What exactly is Jesus doing, and what is he representing? So on the one hand, of course, we see the empire, start with the Roman Empire, right, that very much works from the top down. There's one person at the top, one emperor that controls everything, that has to say, that's basically calling the shots. A lot of people who see that as a problem think that Jesus is simply opposing power. So there's dominant power of the empire that creates a lot of problems, that suppresses people, that exploits people, that makes them work for their own benefits, but that really doesn't help people live a better life. You know, this is why it's so impotent, really, to increase the benefit for everybody. It only increases the benefit for the top. So some people think Jesus was just opposed to power, and then they forget about the alternative. What I'm saying in that book is that Jesus is actually about creating a different form of power. Mm-hmm. And you could talk about this, as a power that's not from above, but from below, that comes from the community, that comes from those who are usually left out, in the empire. So when Jesus preaches good news to the poor, what a lot of people hear is maybe Jesus is interested in helping poor people, giving them a meal or maybe a place in a homeless shelter, right, or something like that. The way I read it is different. I think good news to the poor is not just you will have a hot meal tomorrow, but you will no longer be poor.
Yes.
And then poverty here is not just a matter of, not having enough money, but also not having any power, not having any agency, not being able to actually live a better life, to take care of yourself, to take care of your community. And so when Jesus preaches good news to the poor, as he does really in all of the Gospels, what you're getting here, and this is my interpretation, is really another way of people living together, people power versus elite power.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is also being studied now in the field of New Testament studies. This is what some of my colleagues who are biblical scholars have been working out over the years. Perhaps one of the most interesting persons doing this work is Richard Horsley, who wrote a book by the title Jesus and Empire that I think is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, not just as a critique of empire, but really saying this is what the alternatives look like. And I'd be happy to talk more about that if you would like me to do that.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
So if you think about the situation back in Jesus' own time, what the Gospels tell us, that he was born in the family of Joseph, you know, who was a working person, sometimes called a carpenter, but those folks, of course, were really construction workers. They laborers in construction is what we probably would call it today. And these working people oftentimes had a tough life because it was difficult for them to make ends meet. Coincidentally, a lot of them actually worked on bigger building projects that were produced or put on by the Roman Empire. And so they were, like a lot of construction workers today, exposed to pretty harsh conditions, long working hours, you know, lack of water in a hot climate. And then when the project was done, they were probably laid off, you know, and sent back home. So Jesus, not only through his family, but probably in his own life, would have experienced that. Now, that's sort of what I think we're seeing today with what we're calling essential workers, right? These are people that we're now calling essential workers because we realize without them, we could not survive.
Right.
But in normal times, these people are not really getting a lot of appreciation for the hard work that they're doing. And so the appreciation they are getting, they have to fight for. We see this today also, you know, I mean, what's happening to grocery workers today under COVID-19, they're getting a little bit of a better deal right now, you know, things like hero pay or some consideration, maybe a little bit better deal also, you know, about health testing and so on. But all of that they had to fight for. This is not something that is given to them by some enlightened, boss or emperor, but they have to get together. They have to say, this is what we need. This is what we need to do our work well. And as this is happening today, you know, we can see workers stepping up to the plate, talking about it, bringing this to the public's attention. You can imagine that this is what happened in Jesus' own time as well. So you had these working people pulling together, making their voices heard. And they were doing this not just sort of as a political or an economic protest. They were doing this using their theological, their religious traditions. So in the Hebrew traditions, you know, you have the tradition of the prophets. You have the traditions of the Exodus, where, you know, all the way back, you know, with Moses, you had these Hebrew slaves organizing in Egypt saying, this cannot continue. You had the prophet saying, you know, there's exploitation happening in our world. This cannot continue. And so this is what I mean by organizing. Jesus as an organizer is not just somebody who has a radical message, but he brings people together. And together, they're then the ones that fight for survival, that fight for a better life. And that understand, this is the big thing for me as a theologian, they understand that God is with them in this struggle. So they're not just doing this because, they're doing it for themselves, but this is their way of reclaiming their communities. This is the way of reclaiming their faith, which I think is very exciting. And imagine what that would do for us today.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and Absolutely. So Jesus was very deliberate in his portrayal as a community organizer. As you said, being aware of the social forces and the injustices. And then he sets into motion in defining the concepts of discipleship and community and love. Do you see this as an accurate role as Jesus, as this organizer?
I think so. I mean, start with this notion of discipleship. What does it really mean, right? Disciples are people that follow Jesus, Jesus' way of life. And Jesus' way of life, I mean, the beauty of Jesus is, like I keep saying, he's not just talking. He's also sort of building new kinds of relationships. He's bringing people together. Mm-hmm. You know, he's feeding the 5,000. He's healing people who are in need of healing. He's preaching good news to the poor. He's living good news to the poor. And all, as they do this together, this is what discipleship means. You know, if you used a more modern world a word for discipleship, I think you could really say discipleship is organizing, is bringing people together. And so when the church talks about discipleship, you know, I happen to be United Methodist, there's even a board of discipleship ministry. That sounds very otherworldly, you know, this thing that you do among religious people when you're in the church, that's discipleship. But for Jesus, this is much broader. You know, it is precisely community organizing, bringing people together to work for a better life, for a better world, for a better community. And so discipleship in that regard is much broader. Now, the good thing is, if you look at our religious traditions, there's all kinds of examples for how that has happened through the ages. So we're not inventing something here today that nobody has ever seen. All we're doing is we're simply broadening the horizon of our own Christian traditions again, that are linked, of course, and rooted in the Jewish traditions. We're doing that in such a way that we're reclaiming something that was already there in the Jesus movement, and that so many of the churches today have forgotten.
Well, we can take that a step farther, you know, defining definite groups, networking, modern day Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram. This is another way of organizing. So Jesus obviously didn't have that level of technology available to him during the first century, but he did have ways to bring people together. And thus he became this great leader because he knew about power and ideas and flexibility and uniqueness. So almost like a precursor of the Holy Spirit.
I want to say that it's important to me to listen to you talk, Jorg, about Jesus organizing and people sort of coming together to have a plan. How are we going to do something? Well, the thing that they had to do that Jesus was trying to help them to do, and this is my interpretation, is to resist and survive under the oppression of that system. And he did it at a time, scholars tell us, like you, that he did it at a time of a real crisis, that what was happening in northern Judea, well, it would be Judea, what do we call it, in the Galilee region, was they were, every ounce of their earning power was being stripped away by the Romans, and the person that was at the center of that was, of course, Herod Antipas. And so Jesus, you know, they're all terrified. They're all, you can imagine the panic when they're taxing them not only on the boats that they built, they're taxing them on their nets, fishing nets. They're certainly taxing the fish. So that what little edge, what little margin that these people had on which they could possibly make a living, and I'm not talking about having a TV and a second car, I'm talking about
subsistence,
thank you. So that it's not just Jesus getting an idea one day, it's Jesus responding in a historical setting to a historical crisis. And it seems to me that that really gives us a real edge in looking at who he was and what he was really up to.
I think that's right, David. Thanks for that background here. And, you know, a minute ago I talked about Jesus as a construction worker. And we're talking about essential workers here, right? These are people that are doing the work that needs to be done. This is not something that somebody sitting at a desk, you know, or looking down from on high can actually do. The workers have to do it. Then we have, the fishing people, you know, fishermen that you just mentioned, who are part of this group, and then a large population of peasants. These are people living off the land, planting agricultural workers, that sort of thing.
Yes.
All the way, you know, back if you think about the Christmas stories, you know, these shepherds who are actually also day laborers, basically tending other people's sheep, you know. So you have a lot of these folks who are really experiencing a crisis that may be very similar to what we're experiencing now, you know, where people are losing their jobs or, you know, having trouble making ends meet, and they're realizing that this can only be addressed by people working together, by people building community. And if you look at a lot of sort of Jesus's recommendations or Jesus's commandments, you know, look at the Sermon on the Mount, a lot of this is really about building this community, working together, you know, to sustain themselves, not only to make a living, but also to have a voice. You know, this is then also about building power, where the thing is not just, you know, do we have a nice emperor that takes care of us or a not so nice emperor, but we need a different world where people ultimately have the opportunity to have their voices heard, to make their work count, you know, to actually shape the world in which they're living. And this is, I think, the beauty of it. This is where, again and again and again, you see God at work. You know, in many Christian traditions, and I know this is something where some progressive theologians may disagree a bit, you know, they think about Jesus as a great prophet and as an organizer and all of that. But most Christian traditions also think about Jesus as divine. And if you think about this as God, this is God acting in the world, that's a hugely powerful statement that then you can take back and make use to reshape anything that you ever believed about God. You know, a lot of people think, well, God's up in heaven somewhere, some superior power. You know, you can express this in conservative or in liberal terms. But what we're talking about here is this is God at work in the world, getting the divine hands dirty, organizing, building power, pushing back against the emperor. That's where I think some of the beauty of our traditions rest.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I'm touched by if we want to insist that Jesus was divine, that's personally not important to me as a human being, but I get it. If we're going to insist that Jesus was divine, then we need to pay attention to what that means. And if God is actually working for human beings to be able to live on the planet, then if Jesus is divine, that must be the work Jesus is up to. I just
want to know, right, David? I mean, and no matter, you know, how people ultimately answer this question for themselves, what I want to know as a theologian is what is the basic, you know, principles according to which God is at work in the world? And, you know, the problem is not just the invisible God. The problem is really that God is, for the most part, almost universally in these Christian traditions in which we find ourselves, envisioned as somewhere above the clouds, on top of the universe, dressed like the emperor, ruling like the emperor.
Yes.
And then Jesus becomes a little sort of, you know, mitigating factor here. But what I'm saying is Jesus is deconstructing any and all of these images of God. And therefore, you know, a God that operates from the top down may not be a God. This is, by the way, in the beginning of this book, Jesus versus Caesar, where I'm saying that maybe the Romans had it right when they considered Christians to be atheists. This was an old Roman critique of Christianity that said, you know, you're really atheists.
Yes.
And the reason they said it was not because they didn't believe Christians believed in a God. They knew Christians believed in a God, but the Romans thought the God in whom Christians believed was not really a God. That was something else, you know. Mm-hmm. Was, you know, somebody like Jesus, you know, who was inferior, who ended up on a cross, who seemed to have lost the battle against the Roman Empire. And so that is a critique of theism the way the Romans saw it, you know, theism as top-down, somebody who is always in control, who is always omnipotent and so on. The Romans said, well, this is not real religion. The Christians said, no, this is what religion is. Mm-hmm. It is precisely rebuilding the world from the bottom up, and our God is with us in that. So we have a tremendous clash here in the way we look at God, we look at the world, we look at ourselves. And in this current crisis, this is what I want to encourage here. We are really reclaiming who in this world matters. Who is doing the important work, taking us back to the essential workers. And as we said the other day, keep in mind, you know, when we say workers, you know, that's a very generic term. In our society, these are oftentimes, especially minorities, women, they're the ones who are most affected by the crises. But they're also the ones, I think, who are in a place where the alternatives can be built and where we can do something new. This is where my hope lies, and this is why we're doing certain things through the Wendland Crook program, like working with labor unions, supporting cooperative development efforts, and so on, that ultimately change what's happening around us.
Jorgis, as an attempt to remove the blinders, which I think that's somewhat what we are trying to do, but to reconsider religion as a tool of the empire, in order to have a new world, as you mentioned a few moments ago, I think it's important that we all have the opportunity to see religious symbols differently. For example, the cross. You know, the cross, we wear it around our necks. It's on T-shirts and displayed in all of our churches. I'd like for you to just mention, as we're talking about resistance, let's talk a little bit about that image of the cross. What does that actually mean? You talk about that in your book, Jesus versus Caesar.
Yes, that is a big question, and we probably would have to have another show for that. But let's get this started here, because it is so important. Now, first of all, in the Roman Empire, crosses were reserved for those people who were politically dangerous, that is to say, people who were threatening the power of the empire. That's oftentimes forgotten. You know, we think cross is just a punishment for bad people or thieves, or, you know, maybe it's a religious tool that God uses. But in the Roman Empire, crosses were used for people who became dangerous, and not just dangerous to the Roman Empire, but maybe they're the ones who would have alternatives, you know, different ways of life, you know, bringing people together to live differently. So the fact that Jesus ends up on the cross, I think, means that in this Roman mentality, he was considered dangerous. Of course, he was also considered dangerous by some of the religious leaders of his own time. So the government and religion working together, they found a way to get rid of him. So people ending up on the cross like Jesus, that was the big worry. Now compare that to other people of Jesus's time who were also, you know, maybe dangerous, but who weren't crucified. And it just so happens there was somebody else by the name of Jesus at the time of Jesus of Nazareth. His dad was a person by the name of Hananiah. So this was Joseph, the son of Hananiah, who was out around the temple every day and condemned the Roman Empire and preached doom and gloom. He was somebody that was also annoying to the Romans, but the Romans took him in, they beat him up, and they sent him out again. They let him go. Jesus of Nazareth, as you know, they took him in, they beat him up, and they killed him on a cross. So what was the difference? And one way to think about that difference is to say Jesus ben Hananiah, the son of Hananiah, was a fiery speech writer, you know, a preacher, you know, maybe a talking head. The son of Joseph, Jesus of Nazareth, the Christian Jesus, was somebody who not only had a few select words and speeches, but also somebody who knew how to organize people, how to bring them together, how to build power. And this is why the Romans had to get rid of him. And the other power brokers, of course, were part of that game, right? It's not just the Romans, but it's also some of these high priests who were ultimately selected by the Romans to keep the people in check. So if that's the story of the cross, of course, then the question of the resurrection becomes really important, because it's not just, you know, this is the end, this is how the empire crushes the resistance, but in this Christian tradition of the resurrection, and we just celebrated Easter a few weeks ago, this is now God standing up against the empire and saying, this is not the end. There's something else that's growing out of this. And as we've seen, you know, for 2,000 years, there have been Christian-inspired resistance movements for a very long time. It's just that in our country, we sometimes forgot about them. We now, when we hear Christianity, think immediately of the Christian right and the dominant status quo. But the resistance that led to the cross could never be suppressed by the cross. That's the good news of the crucifixion, you know, to say that God resurrected Jesus, and these movements continued. This, I think, is the meaning of the bodily resurrection. There is an embodied reality. There are movements, there are real people making a real difference that the empire could never kill.
So we could consider looking at the cross as an energy or a symbol of resistance, which is a whole new idea, a whole new way of looking at that symbol.
Well, and the real, yeah, Georg, you go ahead.
And that's what Christianity, I think, ultimately did. You know, this is why we can actually display the cross. I mean, otherwise it would be just depressing and sad that this went wrong. But keep in mind, you cannot have the resurrection without the cross. So this is, I think, in American Christianity, sometimes, you know, Easter is so triumphant. It's almost like the happy ending in a Hollywood movie, you know, sort of the old Hollywood movies that still had happy endings, right? Let's forget about all the bad stuff that happened. But the cross is the reminder that, you know, resistance and also a new world really has to be fought for. It cannot simply, you know, be forgotten how the movement got to that point. And so the beauty of it is, you know, that this resistance ultimately comes through on the other end. And what we've seen, you know, I mean, any and all of the empires have always had their own limits. I mean, you know, Caesar, if you would have interviewed a Roman at the time of Jesus, they would have said, well, the empire will last forever. And it didn't. You know, of course, that's what they thought in the British Empire. The British Empire will last forever. The Germans thought, you know, fascism would last 1,000 years. It didn't. Now today, people think maybe capitalism will last forever. Probably doesn't either. What will last beyond all these things is precisely that resistance, that new way of life that Jesus and the disciples practiced, the way they organized. We saw it back then. We see it now.
Well, and, you know, you can imagine easily, because it's happened over and over in history, that the predominating systems that hold a particular historical period together eventually, and not that and it doesn't take that long, they will finally crumble. I mean, we certainly saw that with Rome, and we've seen it with every empire since. It has a kind of heyday, and it lasts for a while, and people accept it as the ultimate reality. And then when it disappears, people have to start over. I mean, when the structures that they have depended on, provided by the empire, begin to crumble, they're going to do the very thing that we're talking about. They're going to collect together, and they're going to figure out how they're going to survive together. And so capitalism, if you've seen the books by Thomas Picardy, who writes about capitalism, he is predicting even now with his latest book that this system is going to come apart if it doesn't make some very fundamental course corrections. Now, whether or not he is suggesting the course corrections in the way that Jesus would have called for. That's a different thing. But the point is that he's an expert on economics, and has written extensively, first about the French Revolution, the American, and so forth. So the point being is that we do have the knowledge that this thing can't last. Now, in the meantime, how can we help it either transform or not last? How can we see it dissolve so that people can really emerge?
I think that's right, and this is where solidarity will be important, mm-hmm. because ultimately, if you think about back to these essential workers, there's more of these workers than anything else. If these workers ultimately become aware not only of their importance in the system, but of the power they have to push beyond the system, that is what ultimately can change things. And you know, and even after a collapse, even in the midst of this COVID crisis, you see what working people are actually doing. The government is not able to provide enough masks, mm-hmm. So people are sewing masks, mm-hmm. right? The government really was very sluggish. I mean, we're talking about the U.S. government here, and really doing anything, yet people were stepping up to the plate and taking responsibility.
Yes.
And as sort of some people just sit and wait and watch. It is people who are doing this work every day and who are ultimately, the ones who are forced to be doing this work, who we need to be looking for. But that can only happen, it seems to me, if we become clear that this is a matter of solidarity. Now, let's not just talk about the essential workers on the front line, but let's talk about the 99%, since you brought up the Occupy Wall Street movement earlier, David. If you think about the 99%, that really includes all of us who have to work for a living, mm-hmm. who cannot simply live on their investment on their own, and who are in this system less and less benefiting from what's going on. So here, solidarity is not just among the workers on the front line in the trenches, but among the rest of us also, the 99%. Now we're divided. We're in some ways divided and conquered. But there are ways of bringing us together, and this is where I think the hope of this original Jesus movement lies. This is where the hope of a lot of the social movements of our own time lie. This is where the hope of a labor movement lies. You know, this is where the hope of the Black Lives Matter movement lies. This is the hope of the environmental movements, because ultimately what is happening to working people at the front lines is happening to all of us, is happening to the environment, is happening to ecology. And once we realize that we're in this together, that we're ultimately benefiting maybe less from this than we thought, this is what we see in the crisis, we're ultimately not winning this game, then we can start working together. Cautiously, it will take some time, it will take some effort, but we've seen this was possible in the past, and who knows, it might be possible again.
Well, I think we're being given an opportunity to read scripture for those of the Christian tradition a little bit differently, and I want to be specific about this, especially since we're talking about Jesus as organizer. So I want your comments on. Let's just take Matthew 10, starting at verse 5, where it says, these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the leper. So, you know, that to me, if the opportunity is here now to even look at something like Matthew 10 differently, it is a call to for solidarity. It's a call for us to approach life differently and to unite in our efforts. And I think COVID-19 is giving us an opportunity to read this material differently and to read it as Jesus calling us.
Well, if you just look at some of the things that are taking place on television, or on the internet, I should say, mm-hmm. all of these, even commercials, mm-hmm. are picking up the theme. And we can ask, well, do the people paying for those commercials really believe this? But the point is that it's having tremendous mm-hmm. Public appeal, because people are happier, even in a crisis, when they are reminded and begin to depend mm-hmm. upon, again, their community.
Yeah, we're in this together.
Yeah.
We'll get through this together.
Yeah. So it has great popular appeal to people. Mm-hmm. Now, if we can put feet on that with our being in solidarity, then, you know, maybe things can begin to really change.
It's interesting that you're quoting Matthew 10, because this is, of course, you know, Jesus sending out the disciples. This is sort of mm-hmm. an instruction for discipleship. And, you know, if we had time, sort of read through that passage and keep reading beyond what you just read, there's a good deal of community organizing wisdom there. Let me just highlight one thing sort of towards the end, where Jesus basically says, you know, be there in these communities. Don't take your own wealth, you know, work together
right,
with
yes.
the people,
right.
You know, work with them, enter their houses. And then later, Jesus says, if anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, leave that home or town and shake the dust off your field.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that this is necessarily, you know, something that people should be doing quickly, but I think in this current situation, there's some real important advice here, because a lot of people get so fixated on the problem. They get so, you know, frustrated about, say, the president and his party, and their governors, and people in power, and, you know, others who don't want to listen, people in their congregations, you know, people in their own families, that they get so fixated, you know, like the bug drawn to the light, that they cannot
yes.
think of anything else.
Yes.
Part of this advice would be, you know, go and look and see where stuff is really happening. Go there, work there. Where are these working people waking up? Be there with them, become part of that. You know, you wake up in the process, and don't get too fixated on where things are going wrong. So the good news here is, you know, stuff's happening. Pay attention to that. Go there, be part of that, organize together. And then we've talked a lot about religion, Christianity specifically, but in my experience, this is also the place for interreligious dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
In this struggle together, now bring what your own religious traditions tell you, what's the value here. So for us as Christians, we bring the Jesus traditions. Jewish people would bring the prophets, the Exodus. Muslim people would bring insights from Muhammad and the Quran. You know, Buddhists have something to contribute, other religions too.
Yes.
And all of that comes together in a new way, where each of these religious traditions now get new life, get new urgency. We're beginning to see things that we haven't seen before, and that also is exciting, as I see it. And then we find that we may have a lot more in common than we realized
than we
before.
Were told.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, just think about the most ancient traditions. In the Jewish tradition, of course, you go back to the Exodus. Well, it just so happens that Christians also share these traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the Quran, Muslims also go back to the Exodus tradition.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
here's already ancient liberation traditions where working slaves, you know, liberated themselves, and they built something new. That's exciting stuff, and that's what I think you know, this current COVID-19 crisis could help us work through again and see again in new ways.
Yes.
Well, York, I think you're brilliant. I always enjoy our conversations, and especially as we are living in a state of social distancing, I just feel like we are experiencing a rare moment of solidarity mm-hmm. in our conversations.
Yeah.
So I hate to bring it to a close, but we're going to have to, Jorg, and I have no doubt we will be talking with you again.
Yeah, this is not the last you'll hear from us.
I would appreciate that. Yes, I always enjoy these conversations. And for your listeners, let me point them back to this Wendlandt Cook program in Religion and Justice, and also say that we're starting some webinars in the month of May on religion, ecology, and economics. The first one is going to be on May 13. You find the information on our website, which is religionandjustice.org.
We're going to go there. We're going to.
Well, I've already got it on my Google Calendar.
Yeah, we're going to be there. Yeah,
I'll get a reminder. Great. And we're looking forward to that.
And we're going to promote it on the Faith and Reason website, too.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much for that. Yes,
we already are.
Appreciate it.
And we're promoting the Wendlandt Cook program as well.
Yes.
So, Jorg, David, thank you both.
Thank you, Debo.
I so enjoy spending this time. And for those in the 67 countries who are listening to our podcast, I believe that this message hopefully brings us courage and helps us to continue to move forward through this COVID-19 pandemic, and that we will arrive on the other side renewed, refocused,
and in solidarity.
And in solidarity.
Very good. Thank you so much, David and Debo. It's great to be with you.
Thanks, Jorgen. Please join us for our next episode of Faith and Reason 360's response to COVID-19. On that podcast, we hope that we will have Dr. Carrie Day.
Yes.
So we look forward to that. And Carrie is at
Princeton.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So this has been a program of the D.L. Deitch Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason Educational Programming. Please visit our website at www.faithandreason.org.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children.